This is our third session this week, talking about listening for the sound of the genuine and thinking about some of the calling that we have in our lives toward vocations through storytelling and sharing. And today we, are you going to talk about this later? Okay. I guess you need to go. Today we're going to make a little bit of a turn from some work in kind of inside of us, thinking about our cover stories, thinking about learning to share stories and listen, and talking about what it means when we listen for the sound of the genuine, not just in ourselves, but in other people, and how that changes the way that we care for them, that we advocate for them, that we live our lives toward a more justice-oriented kind of lifestyle. So that's where we're headed. We are going to start in this room, and then we're actually going to have you get up. You can leave your stuff, but get up and move next door to the Creekside room for a kind of embodied activity, and then we'll end back in here. So thank you for being with us today. It's hot. It's the end of the day, so we're really grateful you came back and looking forward to this session. We have started our last two classes by engaging in a process of story sharing, and so we're going to try that practice one more time today. Just briefly, if you haven't been here, this process is an interchange between two people, and we usually suggest you talk to someone who you didn't come with, but it can be anyone. And for the first 2 minutes, you'll have a chance to think about the prompt, and then for 2 minutes, one of the persons will speak, sharing their response to this prompt while the other person listens in silence with a lot of reverence and connection. And then there'll be a time to ask a question to kind of open the story up a little, and then we'll swap roles. So we'll walk you through that. Most of you have done this already. So if you would find a partner that you'd be willing to share with, and the prompt we want you to think about today is to tell a story about a time when you were confronted with the harsh realities of the world. So go ahead and find someone to be with.
Anne-Marie and I are impressed because you guys, you've got it. It feels like this practice, does it feel a little more natural than it did the first day for those of you that have been here? Yeah. And I mean, that's the thing. That's why they call these practices, right? As you practice them and eventually they start to get into your bones. And then really, you know, the goal is to the practice falls away, right? And this just becomes a way of being and a way of engaging and a way of engaging differently in the world. And you exercise that. But it is nice to come back and intentionally do this every so often, especially when you have folks that are new to the practice. So a little bit of a recap of where we've been, right? So we've titled this three-session series, Listening to the Sound of the Genuine. In the first section, we did listening, and there's four parts to the listening, right? There's the silence, which is really, that's like a really important part. And then the listening in that space of silence. The testimony piece, which we talked about as the speaking of your truth to another person, and those two, the holy listening and the testimony, go together. And then what's generated in the space between there out of these self-awakening questions is something new often that can emerge in that holy space and out of that listening. So that's the listening part. The sound of the genuine part is what we spent time on Tuesday, looking into our own stories, right, and our own cover stories, the voices that we hear from the outside ourselves, and what is that the story? Is that story true? Is that the truest story? Is that the story we want to tell and live into the world? So that's listening and sound of the genuine. But as Thurman frames this and as we engage it, if you just end with yourself, you've lost something. Because these stories, it's not just my story, but it's our story. And so this practice of listening creates a shared reality. And it goes outward. And so the stories that are out there in the world and the stories that are coming in, we can engage those. And the clearer we are about our own genuine, and then seek to embody that and live that out in the world. So that's what we're doing today, and especially today's kind of a challenge day a little bit, because the stories, especially of the marginalized, Nadia talked about this at her talk on Tuesday night, that, you know, there's those people that live in the corners, and their stories don't get listened to a lot of the time. And so are we able to create a space of listening where those who aren't listened to can find that space? And then then how do we reframe our own stories in light of the stories we're hearing from those that are different from us? And then how do we live differently as a community because of that? So today is called The Danger of a Single Story, and we've been talking, actually all the faculty, there's sort of a thread, if you've noticed, if you've gone to several sessions, about this there's an alternative narrative that's out there that we can listen to, that we can speak, that comes from the Book of Ruth, that's different than what's been taught sometimes in our tradition, and that art has a piece in that, and storytelling, it's part of why we've had poetry and music in there. So this Danger of a Single Story, only having one story and not a lot of ability to deviate from that given story is dangerous. And that comes from someone that we've listened to and heard. And Anne-Marie's going to frame this. We're going to watch a TED Talk.
Yeah, so we're gonna share with you a really abridged version of a TED Talk.
There it is.
Called The Danger of a Single Story. And the speaker is Chimamanda Adichie. She's a Nigerian-American writer and professor who herself was born in Africa, in Nigeria, and now lives in the United States. And so I really commend this full TED Talk to you. It's about 23 minutes. We didn't want to do the whole thing in here, so Eric's abridged it nicely just to kind of get the meat of it. But I use this in my American Lit, in my English 11 classes with students as we move into contemporary literature. And it's something I've used with college students and I think is really a benefit to this conversation around whose stories we listen to and we tell. Do you have subtitles on here?
No, there's
also. Okay. She's a little hard to understand.
Yeah.
Okay. But anyway, all right. So hopefully you'll be able to. She has a bit of an accent as she speaks, but I think you'll be able to get the gist of what she's saying.
Listen well.
So practice your holy listening.
I'm a storyteller, and I would like to tell you a few personal stories about what I like to call the danger of the single story. I grew up on a university campus in eastern Nigeria. My mother says that I started reading at the age of 2, although I think 4 is probably close to the truth. So I was an early reader, and what I read were British and American children's books. I was also an early writer. And when I began to write at about the age of 7, stories in pencil with crayon illustrations that my poor mother was obligated to read, I wrote exactly the kinds of stories I was reading. All my characters were white and blue-eyed. They played in the snow. They ate apples. And they talked a lot about the weather, how lovely it was that the sun had come out. Now, this despite the fact that I lived in Nigeria, I had never been outside Nigeria. We didn't have snow, we ate mangoes, and we never talked about the weather because there was no need to. Now, I loved those American and British books I read. They stirred my imagination, they opened up new worlds for me. But the unintended consequence was that I did not know that people like me could exist in literature. So what the discovery of African writers did for me was this: it saved me from having a single story of what books are. I come from a conventional middle-class Nigerian family. My father was a professor. My mother was an administrator. And so we had, as was the norm, living domestic help who would often come from nearby rural villages. So the year I turned 8, we got a new houseboy. His name was Fide. The only thing my mother told us about him was that his family was very poor. My mother sent yams and rice and our old clothes to his family. And when I didn't finish my dinner, my mother would say, "Finish your food. Don't you know people like Fide's family have nothing?" So I felt enormous pity for Fide's family. Then one Saturday, we went to his village to visit. And his mother showed us a beautifully patterned basket made of dyed raffia that his brother had made. I was startled. It had not occurred to me that anybody in his family could actually make something. All I had heard about them was how poor they were, so that it had become impossible for me to see them as anything else but poor. Their poverty was my single story of them. Years later, I thought about this when I left Nigeria to go to university in the United States. I was 19. My American roommate was shocked by me. She asked where I had learned to speak English so well and was confused when I said that Nigeria happened to have English as its official language. She asked if she could listen to what she called my tribal music and was consequently very disappointed when I produced my tape of Mariah Carey. She assumed that I did not know how to use a stove. What struck me was this. She had felt sorry for me even before she saw me. Her default position toward me, as an African, was a kind of patronizing, well-meaning pity. My roommate had a single story of Africa, a single story of catastrophe. In this single story, there was no possibility of Africans being similar to her in any way, no possibility of feelings more complex than pity, no possibility of a connection as human equals. I will say that before I went to the US, I didn't consciously identify as African. But in the US, whenever Africa came up, people turned to me, never mind that I knew nothing about places like Namibia. So that is how to create a single story. Show a people as one thing, as only one thing, over and over again, and that is what they become. The single story creates stereotypes. And the problem with stereotypes is not that they are untrue, but that they are incomplete. They make one story become the only story. Of course, Africa is a continent full of catastrophes, the immense ones, such as the horrific rapes in Congo, and depressing ones, such as the fact that 5,000 people apply for one job vacancy in Nigeria. But there are other stories that are not about catastrophe, and it's very important, it is just as important to talk about them. I've always felt that it is impossible to engage properly with a place or a person without engaging with all of the stories of that place and that person. The consequence of the single story is this: it robs people of dignity. It makes our recognition of our equal humanity difficult. It emphasizes how we are different rather than how we are similar. Stories matter. Many stories matter. Stories have been used to dispossess and to malign, but stories can also be used to empower and to humanize. Stories can break the dignity of the people, but stories can also repair that broken dignity.
Okay, so I think what I'd like you to do is just sit for a minute and then turn to your neighbor, someone around you, and just have a conversation. Sort of what did you hear that stuck with you? What's valuable? What did you like? Or what did you not like? Okay, so take just a couple seconds to like let it settle down and then turn and talk for a minute. All right, so let's come back together as a large group. I'm wondering if you would either share your own thought or something that the person next to you said that you thought was really profound. So what did you hear from your neighbor? What did you think as you experienced this? How do you reflect on this? What do you think?
Well, the single story, it's really what's up here in my head about most of Africans. You know, we live near Chicago, and this is kind of what we think of the south side of Chicago. You know, even though you know there's so many good people there, you got that one story kind of just.
Yeah, and thanks for admitting that, because that's I think we all have those single stories, right? Mm-hmm. So thanks for sharing that, yeah. Good. What else?
I think from my own standpoint, I think I was, because I worked as a physician in inner city hospitals in Columbia, South Carolina, and then in Detroit.
Okay.
And so I think I was constantly, any impression I ever had was constantly challenged by the next family that came in.
Yeah.
That didn't fit my stereotype, that didn't fit my expectation.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we were talking about Muslim Americans and stereotypes. And again, Detroit has the biggest population of Arabs outside the Middle East. You know, my kids' friends, my neighbors, the people I saw in my practice.
Yeah.
you know, I was constantly, you know, you can't keep a stereotype when you get to know people. Mm-hmm. And I was a psychiatrist, so I got to know a lot about them and their families and their belief systems and how they live.
Right.
And again, you know, the best way to combat having a single story is to get out there and meet a lot of people and get to know them.
And those are many stories, right? It's just story after story after story, and then all of a sudden you go, wait a minute, there are multiple.
Right? Yeah, and I grew up, you know, in the Detroit riots, and my family was you know, we don't go in Detroit, and my grandparents, you know, my grandparents and everybody was like that. Mm-hmm. You know, and I would have been like that if I hadn't been in a job where I had to be real people.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
I had to go to a family reunion. I had to do a 3-hour drive both directions to get there and then to come back. And on the way back, this van kind of cut me off, which irritated me in the first place. But then the second thing I noticed was that he had a Trump sticker on the back, you know, Make America Great Again. And I immediately in my head, I said, oh, that figures. And then the second thing I did is I started visualizing what this person looked like who was driving this van. And the van was a little beat up. And so I had in my mind that it was probably a rural farmer or somebody, kind of a redneck type person that was overweight, and you know, I just had this whole list of things. And so when I pulled past him, I looked over, and sure enough, he was exactly like I thought he was gonna look like. And then I thought to myself, I don't know a single thing about this person or his life. How can I possibly have this narrative in my head without? Oh, all I know is that he put that bumper sticker on his car, and then I thought maybe he bought the car used, or, you know, who knows? Anyway, and we started talking about having similar experiences, and reading a book like Hillbilly Elegy, this is where the art part comes in. Mm-hmm. It's not only can you have experiences with people's stories, but with art, and that how that kind of has changed my perspective.
Thanks. Yeah.
I think the commonality that Deb and I had came out right away with the dangers of a single story is the narrow-mindedness of it, and how in our experiences, our horizons were broadened beyond anything that we had thought, and we both were the ones who were blessed with it, and that everybody is God's human being, beloved.
Thanks.
Yeah, recognizing the sacred story, even with people that are different than us, or maybe especially with people who are different than us, right? There's this sort of spiritual call to say, you know, we're all created in God's image, and how do we identify that in other people? But if we're operating under a single story, you can't.
In one of my experiences as a professor, I taught international students from various places, Malaysia, Japan, Korea, in the Middle East. And from them, I got much more than I gave them.
Yep.
Because they taught me about their culture and the richness of their culture. And I even invited some of them to my home. So, I mean, it was a very broadening experience.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, as I was telling her, we have some friends who are Muslims, good friends. And he's a doctor in a small town in South Dakota where I live. And they decided to leave South Dakota and move back down to Florida because in his practice he was having trouble with getting patients because of a single story, basically.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, that's the reason. I mean, he was brought here by actually the church. Brought him here, you know, but they actually left because of the single story in a small town. It just did not work for them.
Yeah.
So there are many sides to this, and it's very difficult because stereotyping, as she said, is an incomplete story.
Right.
And if people don't know the rest of the story, then they do look at them with with a different lens.
Yeah.
My grandparents on my mother's side were Swedish immigrants, and so they came over and didn't know the language. And they had, like, a brother that had gone before, so they connected with the brother, and that was kind of it. And they didn't speak the language. They didn't know how to navigate the world. My grandfather, until the day he died, I couldn't understand him. Hmm. My grandmother learned the English from her kids in school. And so my grandparents were fearful of strangers. Mm-hmm. And so they wanted to connect with people they knew of Scandinavian descent and to help them and like-minded. And so I can see where stereotypes and sticking together, it gets perpetuated.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a safety thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so you decide what is typical Muslim behavior. And if you say, oh, they're like loud and brash and arrogant, and that is really difficult for me being Swedish, where you don't show any emotion. It's like, I'm going to stay away. That's really scary for me. And so I think some of these stereotypes get started out of a safety thing, and you're trying to predict how is that person going to act. And we can be enriched by interacting with different cultures, but if you're not feeling safe, or you're tired, you know, it's a shortcut to making a decision is clumping people and presuming behavior. I mean, these things get formed for a reason.
Yeah. Hmm. I mean, I think the question I would ask back is, do we just let... I'm with you, but that's hard for me too, because my question back is, do we just throw up our hands and say,
well,
we're different, we're afraid, right? So it's like what, how do we help? I don't know. Just in a gentle way, I think I'm with you, because I agree with you. I think that stereotypes happen. I hear you, that they happen because we're different. Mm-hmm. And is that it?
Well,
maybe that's what I'm asking. What do you think? Or anyone else?
On my way here, I flew to Seattle, and next to me was like a middle-aged white woman on that side, and on this side was a little bit younger Muslim woman who had the henna tattoos. And I talked to this woman and not that woman because, so she obviously spoke English. But I didn't know what to say. And I'm going on vacation, and I'm tired, and I just didn't have, like, the energy or the want to reach out. And it was a missed opportunity.
Yeah. I was going to say, you kind of pause and say, I wonder what the conversation with her would have been like.
I would have loved to have heard about her. I had that tattoo. Is she going to a wedding?
And that could have been an opportunity to ask, and I'm with you, because it's
too
easy.
Tired, and I just took the easy route.
Yeah, well, and that's okay, because we sometimes forget what you meant.
But
also, what did you miss?
Happen.
Right.
What did you miss? What could you have learned?
Yeah,
right.
I'm with you.
Maybe on the way home you'll be rested.
Intellectually, I get it.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, thank you for your courage to share this and to like admit that, because you're in a room of strangers, kind of, and so that's really brave to be able to say that. And it, please, I'm thinking aloud too, you know, trying to.
I mean,
it is.
The conversation about northern and southern Ireland.
Right. That Glennon. Yeah. That Glennon.
One of the single stories is that we, as enlightened, educated, you know, with it people, will always take the opportunity to cross cultures.
Yeah.
That's not always the case either. Right?
Yeah.
That's a cover story,
yeah.
Yeah, in the front, yeah.
Well, if we look at our American history, how many races, how many nationalities have come through and suffered and are thriving?
Yeah.
And now it's the Muslims' turn, maybe? And well, what can we learn? How did they become the past ones become successful in being accepted? Mm. And, you know, I've never heard any dialogue about, well, what did they do that facilitated their success and that we could use now?
Yeah.
Well, what did we do to welcome them? Because we are the immigrants, and or our, you know, our parents or grandparents were. What was it about our parents and grandparents? What did they hear? What was the community around them saying? You know, my mother was classic. She had an international inner city kindergarten, and she brought home languages and experiences and food. Food is an easy way to share.
Cross
cultures, right? If we're brave enough to taste something that's not white and bland.
Well, I think we. I mean, I'm the advisor for the Black Student Union at my school, and I would tell you that my African-American students, they don't feel fully welcomed yet. I mean, I think it's easy to think like, oh, we've done that here, so we can do that here, but I'm not, I think everyone's still on a journey of feeling that kind of opportunity, welcome, that kind of thing. So, but I think it's wonderful discussion. I'm going to move us on just because we have more to do, but thank you, and I hope you keep chewing on this and thinking about it, and you're all, you know, That thinking is what moves us along and helps us connect to other stories. So
what we want to pull out now from all of this reflection and from your experience are we're going to brainstorm a list of what are some of the single stories that operate in our lives, in our culture. Let's just kind of make a list, and we're going to choose some of them and do some engagement with them. But right now we just want to pull up from you what are some of the single stories that operate in your life or in the world that we live in?
Immigrants are either dangerous or that they take something from us, jobs or property.
Competition, enrich us.
I would add that many people do not see refugees as legitimate.
That might be another single story. Yeah, I'm thinking that another single story. Yeah.
Refugees have no legitimacy.
Are we only talking about refugees?
No, really broadly. I mean, you can think politically, you can think economically, you can sort of any facet of our more shared life, less of our individual story, but more of our like shared life.
Yeah.
Homeless are lazy and want to live outdoors.
Under a bridge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they choose to live that way.
They choose to live that way.
Yeah.
Rich people are selfish.
Addicts lack self-discipline.
What?
Addicts lack self-discipline.
I'm gonna let Anne-Marie catch up. So hold, just think and hold your thought.
Police are trigger happy.
Okay. That's a pretty good summary. Did you have something to add? Oh, I thought yes. Right, your hand. What are some of the, yeah?
If you're not white, you're not really an American.
Yeah. What else? Yeah.
Gay men are dangerous around kids.
What other single stories?
We live in a post-racial society.
Okay. Obviously.
Yeah, we solved that race problem.
Yeah. Maybe taking off of that, I'd say something along the lines of somehow America is like the greatest thing since sliced butter or sliced bread, and like we're the greatest of everything.
There's no such thing as institutional racism.
If you haven't gone to college, you know, someone who hasn't gone to college probably couldn't be a very good conversationalist or know much that would interest me.
If you don't go to college, you're not smart and interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, if
families don't go to church anymore because they're too busy.
Oh.
Sorry.
Sometimes those stories apply, but
that we have to spend a lot of money on defense.
Hold on just a minute. I'm sorry. I can't.
Hold on. Let her catch up. She's still on Young Families. Just ponder in silence. We'll adopt our spiritual practice.
Was the one after Young Families in church?
We have to spend a lot of money on defense.
That was a good one. Okay, and then you can go before you lose it.
Indians are rich because they have casinos.
Okay.
And can I? Do you mind if I change the word Indian to Indigenous people or Native Americans? Just because I was thinking Indians until I thought what you were saying. Okay.
Can I just say something that seems just? I'm not sure that it goes along with this, but it in a way does. I think we forget that they have stereotypes of us.
Ah, interesting.
And I had an experience that was really an awakening when I was working with these students from the Middle East, because I was wearing a blouse that day that was, I didn't think it was revealing at all. It was just a nice blouse. And I heard them talking about me behind me in the hallway. And I heard them say, oh, you've got to remember she's just an American. So after that, I was very careful how I dressed. Because I didn't want to behave in a way that was, offensive to them.
And maybe
one of the things that I'm noticing about this list, I don't know, it's partly because I agree with all of it, but what I'm also seeing is we're only telling kind of our same stories.
Yeah.
Like, we're not talking about people who own guns, or we're not talking about Wall Street people, we're focused on where we see the stories playing out.
Okay.
Which is our starting point, always. Yeah. I mean, that's the only place we can start from, but you're right, it's an interesting observation.
So maybe that's a challenge to think a little more broadly. What did you have something?
Is that a pretty good list? There's a lot here, now we have to whittle them down. We can't do all of these.
Well, so ponder through the list and see if there's, and I'll have Anne-Marie read them, but ponder through and see if there's one or two that just feel like they're catching you for some reason. Either there's something you feel like this is a really important single story to wrestle with, or to challenge, or it for whatever reason in your guts, like this is the one that hits me today to engage with. So Anne-Marie, read them, and then.
All right. So we have to spend money on defense for a safe country. Immigrants are dangerous or competitive, meaning that they're taking jobs. That's what I meant by that. Refugees have no legitimacy. Homeless people are lazy, or they choose to live that way. All rich people are selfish. Addicts lack self-discipline. Police are trigger happy. Without a college degree, a person isn't smart or interesting. Indigenous or Native people are rich because of casinos. We live in a post-racial society. America is the greatest thing since sliced bread and butter. No such thing as institutional racism. Young families don't go to church because they're busy. If you're not white, you're not really American. Gay men are dangerous around kids.
Okay, so think of your kind of top two or three, and we're gonna just have you raise your hand. That's on my short list. We're gonna see if we can get down to like four of these as kind of the ones that feel most important in the room. So read them, and then and I'll count.
We have to spend money on defense for a safe country.
So if that's in your top three, okay.
Immigrants are dangerous or competitive.
Two.
Refugees have legitimacy.
Have no
legitimacy.
One.
Sorry.
Two.
Homeless people are lazy or choose to live that way.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten.
Okay. All rich people are selfish.
One.
Addicts lack self-discipline.
One, two, three, four, five.
Police are trigger happy.
One.
Without a college degree, a person isn't smart or interesting.
One.
Native or indigenous people are rich because of casinos.
None.
We live in a post-racial society.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
America is the greatest nation. No such thing as institutional racism.
1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, and we can combine some too.
That's... Young families don't go to church because they're busy.
1, 2, 3.
If you're not white, you're not really American.
1.
Gay men are dangerous around kids, or stereotypes around people in the LGBTQ community.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Okay, so it looks like...
Let's get themes. So we've got LGBTQ, homeless.
Something about race, for sure.
So just circle race, just circle race.
That's this one.
Okay.
And... maybe just three, Eric.
Okay.
Should we just go, just because it's not a fine
so
group?
If we split into three groups sort of evenly around LGBTQ, homeless, and racism, just the single stories around that, does everybody feel like there's a place that you might be drawn? So who would, if you had to pick one, who would go to homeless? That's about three. Who would go to LGBTQ? And who would go to racism? That's pretty good.
I didn't raise my hand because I would be happy
here. Okay, well, why don't you join the smallest group?
Which might be was that homeless?
Yeah, I think it was a homelessness group. So we're gonna transition into the other space for a little bit, but you can leave your stuff.
Do you want to explain?
We're gonna come back.
What we're doing?
Yeah, let's just explain in there when we come back. So I want to get them into the groups before they. So yeah, so remember which group. Bring your water bottle if you want. We'll be about 45 minutes, maybe half hour, 45 minutes in there. So
make sure you've grabbed a candle. Given more time, we had one last journal prompt for you, which asked you to think about what part of the story that you're living in your current life you want to keep living, and what new story you might want to live into, or how might you reshape how you understand the story that you're living or the role that you play in creating a space for other people's stories. And just to tie back into the sound of the genuine, so we had wanted to close, we're not going to have time, we want to close by reading you just a few parts from the sound of the genuine, but fear not, because it's faculty vespers tonight, and so you will actually hear it from Eric and me a little later, so you'll get to kind of let that be part of your closure.
So ponder just for a minute on taking in all that we've done either today or if you've been through the series, thinking about these questions. What is the sound of the genuine? Digging into your story, all of this and all that we've just experienced and embodied. And what is the story that you feel called to tell from here forward? And just spend it like what's the heart of that story for you as you go out from this experience back into wherever you're going? So just ponder on that for a minute. And then if you can come up with a name for that story that you could fit on that little tag.
Here's some pens.
You know, mother of dragons, keeper of the waterhole.
It could also just be your name.
Or your name.
Just who you are, you know?
Yeah, something that captures who you are, the sound of your genuine, and the story that
you
want
to write?
Live into. Does that make sense?
So as a kind of closing ritual, because one of the things Eric and I love doing when we work with students of any age is to just kind of leave you with something sort of holy and sacred that's spoken into the space, and then give you something to take with you to remind you. This is kind of what we've been thinking about. So I think we'll just go around and we'll just light your candle.
We have permission, by the way.
Yeah, we got special permission from the pastors to just light your candle and share aloud what you've written on your... All right.
Thank you
Have
all.
A good evening. Yeah. Thank you.
And you can't light these again until you're home.
But yeah, sorry. But take them with you. They're yours.
I heard you give a hand to you.